Preparing for war today on the world. I'm Carol Hills. Erica McSwan was only 7 years old when 9/11 happened. Now she's in the Army and getting ready to spend a year in Afghanistan. We caught up with her as she packed.
Pillow, laundry detergent. I brought my hammock, some coffee and protein powder, civilian pajamas, slippers, my Patriots coffee mug. Little things.
Plus, Russian trolling? Yep, that's nothing new.
Long before, you know, we ever heard of Russian interference in the U.S. presidential elections, long before these stories of Russian trolls using Facebook and Twitter, the Kremlin was trolling its own citizens.
That's all ahead here on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and you're with The World. Thanks for being with us today. We begin with the ongoing war of words between Britain and Russia. Britain blames Russia for the poisoning of a former Russian spy in the UK 11 days ago. Sergei Skripal and his daughter are still in critical condition after being exposed to a nerve agent. Russia denies any involvement. Today, Britain's defense minister said Russia should go away and shut up after he was asked about Moscow's response to the case. And of course, yesterday, the British government announced the expulsion of 23 Russian diplomats in retaliation. Arkady Ostrovsky is Russia editor at The Economist. He says there are bigger issues than just the diplomats.
The key question is the one about the finances. London has traditionally been very weak on targeting those who enjoy the financial infrastructure, the legal infrastructure, the real estate, etc. There is a lot of dirty money sloshing around here.
How important is London as a location for Russia's elite?
It's very important. And we're not just talking about shopping or buying real estate here. We're talking about London as being the financial center. And particularly Putin aides, cronies, his associates, how differently they are treated in New York and in Britain. Britain offers a much more lax environment for them.
In what way?
In a sense that Congress has passed the bill naming Russian officials and associates of Putin and putting them on the specially designated national list. Once those people are identified, they cannot operate in America. They cannot use its legal or financial infrastructure.
Can't Britain do the same thing as the U.S.?
Well, it has been reluctant to do this for a very long time. And Russians who sort of part of the regime know that they can engage the British legal system. They can hire the best libel law firms. They can hire the best lawyers, corporate lawyers. So whenever Britain has said, look, we are a country ruled by law, this allows these individuals to use the system. It's a question of political will, really, is whether Theresa May has enough political will, whether she can actually argue that the national interest, the security and the national interests of the country should be put above the financial or economic consideration. You need to go after the individuals who you think, on the basis of your intelligence work or the analysis, as being absolutely critical to the regime and to security services in Russia. If you do that, then everything will follow from that.
I want to ask about the other thing you mentioned, which is the fact that Theresa May would like to do something about the fact that, this nerve gas, this kind of chemical weapon was used on British soil. What can she or the British government do to push back on that?
You're absolutely right. This is, I think, where she has been much stronger. She has put this in terms of it's not just an attack on the ex-Russian spy. It's not even just an attack on Britain. It's the use of prohibited chemical weapons in peacetime by a country which is a signatory to the prohibition of chemical weapons. Russia should not be actually storing the piles of chemical weapons. She is putting it both to the UN and to NATO Council. She is effectively invoking Article 5, saying that this is a matter of collective security of all NATO countries. It should be taken as such. Britain needs the allies. The allies also need Britain because it is, in a way, sort of at the forefront, you know, at the front of this. And I think that will carry a lot more weight. And I think it will be an incentive for the allies in America and in Europe to join ranks with Britain.
Arkady Ostrovsky is the Russia editor of The Economist. Thanks so much, Arkady.
Great to be with you. Thank you.
The U.S. also took action against Russia today, expanding sanctions against spies and trolls accused of meddling in U.S. elections. Also on the list, the so-called Internet Research Agency, a now infamous troll farm in St. Petersburg, and the financier behind it. Charles Maines joins me now from Moscow to talk about the whole trolling phenomenon. Hey, Charles.
Hi, Carol. How are you?
Pretty good. You know, it's been really wild to see this troll story rear its head again in all the news of the past few weeks. What does it look like from over there?
Well, you know, officially Russia says, of course, this troll farm doesn't exist. We've had comments by Vladimir Putin talking about rogue patriot hackers, essentially, who might be involved in something like this. But for those who pay attention, you know, it's an awfully familiar story because long before, you know, we ever heard of Russian interference in the U.S. presidential elections, long before these stories of Russian trolls using Facebook and Twitter, you know, the Kremlin was trolling its own citizens.
Really? I mean, in similar ways?
Well, yeah, the tactics are similar, but for very different reasons. And the story, you know, it really picks up here. So this is back in December of 2011 when tens of thousands of Russians, they took to the streets to protest what they felt were stolen elections. The internet played this huge role in the movement because people were essentially sharing evidence of vote rigging, and of course they were using these online platforms to get people out on the streets. And the problem was that while all this was happening, the images of all these people on the streets were being shared on social media, while on state television there was nothing. They just totally ignored the story. So there was this real gulf in kind of realities, and the Kremlin really woke up to the power of the web. And this, I think, brings us to this idea of these Kremlin troll factories, or troll farms, as we call them. And we've heard so much about these, but, you know, what I wanted to do was just talk to a Russian journalist who'd gone undercover at one. In fact, the most famous one, which is the Internet Research Agency in St. Petersburg.
All right, let's hear it.
Vitaly Bespalov wasn't looking to become a troll, not at all. As he tells it, the trolls, they found him. A recent arrival to St. Petersburg after graduating from a journalism school in his native Siberia, Bespalov was on the hunt for a reporting gig in the summer of 2014 after his initial job with a local news website suddenly fell through. Journalism jobs in St. Petersburg are hard to come by, particularly if you're new in town. So Bespalov starts sending out resume after resume, hoping to find something, well, really anything, that involved editing or reporting. And he wasn't having much luck until one day, the phone rings. It's a possible gig, and it pays double the going rate.
I had no idea who it was. They just called me and told me to show up tomorrow at this address, Zavushkina. And I didn't understand what the job was or what the company was, but I said, sure, why not?
He does a quick check online. No businesses registered to that address, but he heads over to Zavushkina 55, a nondescript four-story business center, for his meeting. There, things get stranger. Security is heavy. Camouflage guards demand his passport and his home address just to get into the building. And then there's a woman throwing a fit in the lobby. She's yelling something about how she won't be part of this. And Bespalov is wondering, just what is this place? A brief interview follows. A woman named Anna has him take a writing test and provide past work samples. Articles Bespalov has written with sympathetic takes on Russia's opposition, LGBT rights, and the feminist art collective Pussy Riot.
I still don't understand why they took me, but she came back with a smile and said, well, we don't cover the kind of stories you do, but you know how to write.
Bespalov was hired. And right away, he's assigned to cover the war in East Ukraine, or sort of. He's told to rewrite articles, 20 a day, for a handful of fake Ukrainian news websites, changing the text to give it the appearance of originality and a distinctly pro-Russian slant. Now, of course, by this point, Bespalov has figured out. He's clearly inside some kind of propaganda machine. The question now was what to do about it.
I could either leave right away, so as not to ruin my reputation as a journalist, or I thought, I can stay and find out more, and publish a big story about it somewhere.
Bespalov went undercover.
He paints a gloomy picture of troll life inside Sabushkin 55, rotating 12-hour shifts, cameras everywhere, and a highly organized operation. A fake news division on one floor, bloggers and social media commentators on another, and then there was that graphics department, people who made picture memes or demotivators for others to copy and embed in postings. Bespalov says collectively the point of all this work was to complete what he calls a circle of lies, a feedback loop where troll postings reinforce Kremlin news on state media, with both pushing one central idea.
Make Russia great again.
Make Russia great again.
The work was directed at the Russian audience. Even the fake Ukrainian sites weren't there to change minds in Ukraine. The point was to remove Russian doubts about the war in Ukraine and about ourselves, because we have a weak economy, because we have few political freedoms, and because Russia can't launch a company like Apple or develop an innovative space program. But what we can do is create the appearance of a great country, not make the country better, but create the impression we have.
In the end, Bespalov spent 3.5 months at the troll farm. He says that once he felt he'd learned all he could, he quit. And he did publish his investigation, although anonymously, out of fear for his safety. In fact, he was threatened. Someone had figured out he was the mole. But things eventually settled down, in part because it turns out Bespalov wasn't the only journalist working undercover at the IRA. Other media had come out with their own investigations. And it's at this point that the whole story probably would have faded, if not for one thing.
The indictment charges 13 Russian nationals and 3 Russian companies for committing federal crimes while seeking to interfere in the United States political system.
The Internet Research Agency's role in the 2016 U.S. presidential elections. Now, to be clear, Bespalov had nothing to do with any of that. All he can say is that he noticed that the troll factory started advertising for English-speaking positions around the time he quit. Still, his willingness to talk about his time at Sabushkin 55 has made him a go-to source for Western media covering the election scandal.
Is this it? This is the building?
Yes, 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 of course.
The troll factory.
Yes.
Tonight, a look inside Russia's disinformation campaign from 26-year-old Vitaly Bespalov.
And the attention in the West has made him an object of scorn on Russian state media as they deny the election meddling charges. Bespalov says both sides get the story wrong.
In the U.S., they label me as Vitaly Bespalov, former troll, not a journalist. And from the Russian side, I'm a liar and a traitor. A lot of my friends tell me, enough already, no more interviews. Have you lost your mind? Do you want to get killed? You've told your story, and talking to more people about it won't change anything else.
But Bespalov does keep talking to the press. Some think because he's promoting himself, grabbing at 15 minutes of fame. Others say he's just trying to earn back his reputation or maybe clear his conscience. But Bespalov, he has a different take. He's just being the journalist he always wanted to be. And if he's known for the troll story for now, that's okay. He's only 26. With some luck, he'll have a lifetime of stories to tell. For The World, Charles Maines, St. Petersburg.
If you want to see those demotivator memes Charles mentioned, we've got a bunch of them up at PRI.org. Boko Haram abducts schoolgirls again. That's up next on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and you're with The World. Remember the hashtag Bring Back Our Girls? It went viral 4 years ago after the militant group Boko Haram abducted about 270 girls from a school in Chibok in northeastern Nigeria. Well, 4 years later, more than 100 of those young women are still missing. And just weeks ago, another abduction by Boko Haram. This time, the militants kidnapped more than 100 girls from a school in the town of Dopchi. Few believe the Nigerian government's promises to find them. Author Adobe Trisha Nwambani is in the capital, Abuja. She says Nigeria's government doesn't have the resources or organization to track down the missing teens.
They sent the military into the forest to look for the girls. They've combed the entire area. They did that for a few days, and still the girls haven't been found, which is similar to what happened during Chibok. So the girls seem to have disappeared into thin air.
And I understand President Buhari visited himself. Was that seen as an important step?
President Buhari visited Dapchi, something that didn't happen in the time of Chibok. So he did that, and the parents felt comforted. even though they complained they weren't given enough time to speak and express themselves. But the president did make a speech and assure them that he would find their daughters. And they said he's a man of integrity and they believe his word and therefore they're expecting their daughters to be found.
After the 2014 kidnapping in Chibok, didn't the government take measures to try to prevent these abductions from happening again? I mean, including arming guards at schools?
I know it's unrealistic to expect any armed forces in this world to guard every single school. So I was one of those who felt after the 2014 kidnappings that the government needed to send armed forces, armed guards to every single school. But after visiting those areas, I realized that it's unrealistic. In fact, someone said recently that if the armed forces did that, they wouldn't have anyone left to do anything else. Of course, we wish the government had done more. But realistically, the only way to safeguard the schools in northeast Nigeria, from what I've seen, is to defeat Boko Haram, because it's impossible to have the military guarding every single school. When the bombings began in, you know, a few years ago, maybe 2011, when Boko Haram was bombing locations around the country, especially churches, a lot of churches began to employ armed guards, of course, hire military. So it's really expensive, but churches that can afford it are investing in it, in screening people who come into the buildings. But I don't know that the government can do that for every single school.
It's an interesting parallel to the U.S., where, as you know, we've had terrible school shootings, and there's arguments back and forth about whether to arm teachers or have armed security personnel in school. But I understand that Nigerian parents also object to having armed guards at schools. Why?
Parents object to having armed teachers at school, not armed guards. I've been living in Abuja before the Boko Haram bombings, and I'm still here after the insurgency, and I see the difference. Even malls, you can't go into the mall. Going into a mall is like passing through security at the airport. Going into church every Sunday morning, my bag is ransacked. I go through metal detectors and everything. It's just standard for those of us who live in this part of the world. So parents are not opposed to having guards, armed guards, at school gates and the military, but it's armed teachers that people are concerned about, especially because we have issues with punishment. There have been circumstances where teachers brutalized students in the process of punishing them. A teacher lost his temper and whipped a child to the point that they were bleeding. There have been several cases like that. 2 months ago, there was a video that went viral of a teacher really brutalizing a number of students, all in the name of punishment. So you can then imagine what a teacher might do with a gun if he lost his temper. So that's where people are uncomfortable. Don't arm the teachers, but they want armed guards at the schools, not teachers.
Nigeria's President Muhammadu Buhari has made the plight of the kidnapped girls central to his presidency, but he hasn't been able to deliver on his promises, and he's up for re-election next year. Does this issue threaten his presidency?
Sadly, I think after the Bring Back Our Girls campaign and 4 years of the Chibok thing, it doesn't have the issue doesn't carry the same weight and level of shock it did at that time. When the girls were kidnapped in 2014, the world wasn't quite aware of the fact that thousands of girls had gone missing in the year before the Chibok kidnapping. So I doubt that Dapchi would have an effect on his re-election if he's going to be re-elected. Like, Dapchi won't carry the same weight as Chibok did when the whole world was talking about it, when everybody was eager for the girls to return and thought it was incredible that 200 and something girls would go missing. So President Buhari isn't necessarily being made to look inept because that has happened under him, because it's happened before. And in the past 4 years, more girls have been kidnapped.
Now, Secretary of State Tillerson, he's now former Secretary of State Tillerson. Mm-hmm. He cut short his trip to West Africa. In fact, Abuja was his last stop. And he came home to the news that he's no longer Secretary of State. How was his visit received in Nigeria?
You know, it was very touching. The morning after he left, I spoke with one of the parents in Dapchi. And he said, after I asked him the questions I wanted to ask him, he said, that please, can he ask me some questions? And I said, yes. He said he heard that the United States government sent someone to Nigeria. That do I know if they talked about their daughters? I said, yes, that they talked about the Chibok girls and the Dapchi girls. And I gave as much update as I knew from the press release, you know, after the meeting, Tillerson's meeting with President Buhari. And he was so relieved. He felt, thank you so much. I could hear his smile over the phone. He said, thank you so much. You're a real journalist. I'm so happy to hear this. So there was a lot of hope from people like the Chibok parents and Dapchi parents. You know, they hear these things over the radio and it gives them hope. somebody from America came all the way here to talk about our daughters. Of course, we know that that's not all he came to talk about. But then people, especially people affected by the insurgency, are usually glad to see that the United States is still in partnership with Nigeria. And it gives them hope that the world hasn't forgotten them. And the interesting thing is, still speaking about school shootings, the Chibok parents were actually planning to come to Abuja and do a lie down kind of thing that a student did in front of the White House, students in the United States. They wanted to do something similar, either in the Nigerian Senate or the U.S. Embassy. They were actually planning that sort of thing to tie their own issue with what was happening in Florida. And then the Dapchi kidnappings happened and truncated that plan. So there's that link. They constantly want to establish a link with America and know that America is still interested and America, what's happening in America is, you know, that sort of thing. So there's that hope people have when they see an American face here, a big name face being present at a time like this.
Well, once Secretary of State Tillerson came home and was fired, how did the Nigerian media respond to that?
It's just been a joke, to be honest. There were things like, the rates of unemployment is so high in Nigeria that even Tillerson got affected. He came here and he also lost his job. You know, so people are still amused.
Author Adobe Tricia Nwabani is based in Abuja, Nigeria. Thank you so much, Adobe.
Thank you, Carol.
Before we take a break, here's a quick preview of a story we'll have for you tomorrow on the show. It's about Dan Carino, a graphic journalist in California who was born in the Philippines. He recently decided to dig into his own family's immigration story.
I definitely cried a couple of times in the process, and so did my mom when I interviewed her.
Because it took years for Dan, his brothers, and his parents to all be together again. Dan's father was the first to leave the Philippines for a job in New Jersey.
That was the first time that I realized that we might not be together.
Then his mom left. It took a decade to reunite. And this is the first time Dan and his parents are talking about it.
They really had our best interest in mind, regardless of what I thought at the time was them just leaving their kids.
10 years to become an American family. That's tomorrow. I'm Carol Hills. This scientist remembers discovering Stephen Hawking's book as a teenager in Iran.
As if it was yesterday, I remember reading the title in Farsi, A Brief History of Time, and I was like, it can't be A Brief History of Time.
So she took it with her, everywhere. How Hawking inspired Sona Hosseini, coming up on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. I read a quote in the New York Times this week that struck me. Caitlin Forrest, an Afghanistan expert, told the paper that the Afghan war is now almost old enough to vote. Let that sink in for a second. The war in Afghanistan is now in its 17th year. Many young Americans have grown up with it, and that includes some of those who are now deploying to Afghanistan as part of President Trump's push to increase troop levels there. The World's Shirin Jafari visited the Fort Carson Army Base in Colorado Springs and spent some time with one soldier who's getting ready to go.
Do you think you would be in the Army if 9/11 hadn't happened?
To be honest, probably not.
First Lieutenant Erica McSwan was just 7 years old when 9/11 happened. Yet she has vivid memories of it. Her family lived in New Hampshire at the time. Her dad commuted to New York City for work. And on that morning, he was running late for a meeting.
He didn't get far before it was like a black blanket covered him. And he just crouched down, and then he couldn't see anything. The city went absolutely silent, which is obviously so unusual for New York City.
With the help of a first responder, she says he managed to get inside a nearby restaurant. Saw on TV that there'd been an attack. He was shaken, but a few hours later managed to rent a car and drive back home to New Hampshire.
All in all, it had a huge, huge impact on me. My dad could have died in that situation.
This was in the back of her mind when, in junior year of high school, she was recruited to swim at the U.S. Military Academy at West Point. Swimming was fun, but she wanted to get involved with the military.
My specific inspiration for going was because I had a sense of purpose in protecting my family. Also, broadly speaking, those who I knew that could also be affected by terrorism and other acts of violence.
Thank you.
Today, Max Swan is an intelligence officer in the army. She's 23 years old and only a couple of days away from her first deployment to Afghanistan. Her day at Fort Carson begins at sunrise, standing in formation in a frozen parking lot.
Face! Insurgents, take charge, conduct preparatory drill.
Like the other 50 or so soldiers lined up around her, she's in her army workout gear. Chin up, shoulders back, hair pulled in a tight bun.
How was it? Good. Typical, so everyone pretty much memorizes those drills.
After the exercise is over, she heads to her office.
So this is where you work?
Yes, this is the office, so they're all pretty military standard.
Max Swan's tour in Afghanistan will last for about a year, with no visits home. So I wonder, what are a soldier's last few days before deployment like? First, ordinary stuff. Things you do before going away on any long trip.
Oh, what am I going to miss? And what do I have to do in advance? Like taxes and ensuring that your house is okay and that your car has a place to be stored and whatnot. Utility bills, credit cards.
But basically, of course, this is no European vacation. These soldiers are going to a battlefield, and they each have to have a plan in case the worst happens and they don't come home.
For me, since I don't have a spouse or children that I would like to will specific things to, I'll just let it go to next of kin, which is my mom.
But Max Swan doesn't only have herself to worry about. The 23-year-old is the leader of her platoon. That means she's responsible for the safety and well-being of 26 other soldiers, all men.
Okay. So
I sit in on one of her training sessions. This one is not so much about the fighting, but more to do with the culture the soldiers are about to enter. It's called How to Handle Islamic Texts.
Does anybody know what percentage of Afghanistan is Muslim? Higher. Not 99.7%.
The soldiers in Max Swan's platoon range in age between 18 and 45. They sit on metal chairs, listening closely.
We obviously want to be considerate of their culture.
It's no accident that Max Swan is talking about the sensitivity surrounding Islamic material. In 2012, American soldiers burned copies of the Quran that they said Taliban prisoners used to write messages in. Word got out, and hundreds of Afghans poured into the streets in protest. The protests lasted for 5 days and left 30 people dead, including 4 Americans. This is not a scenario Max Swan once repeated. Max Swan's office is small but cozy. A New England Patriots calendar hangs on the wall next to her desk, a reminder that she's from Boston. Her parents are devout Christians, she says, and they passed their faith on to her. She's the first in her family to join the military. I ask her what it's like to be in charge of 26 soldiers, some of whom are twice her age.
It is a lot when you think about the leadership that have been in the Army for 20, 30 years. It's difficult to put yourself out there and say, all right, well, I'm in charge and I'm going to make the rules. And that's why I try not to be like that as a leader. Although at the end of the day, I make the decisions.
Okay. All right, here we are.
I can also show you the inside. It's like, it's pretty packed.
Every soldier in Max Swan's platoon gets to take a box full of personal items with them. Think of it as a checked bag on a regular flight.
Some coffee and protein powder, civilian pajamas, slippers.
Max Swan says she's packed enough toiletries and coffee for about 2 months. After that, she can either buy things like shampoo on base or order them online. It turns out Amazon delivers to army post offices in Afghanistan.
And the shipping is not very expensive at all.
Given that Max Swan is an intelligence officer, she won't be leaving the base much. There are upsides and downsides to that. Upside, she likely won't be dodging bullets. Downside?
Honestly, the whole stir craziness of just being contained in that space, like going between your bed and your work site and the gym and where you eat.
To call home, she'll need to buy her own Wi-Fi, which can cost up to $80 a month.
Hey, Erica. Yes, you got a minute?
As the time I have with Max Swan draws to an end, I want to know her thoughts on this war. On the war that has lasted for most of her life. The war that some Americans feel has dragged on for far too long. I mean, to her, what does winning even look like?
I think for me, if our platoon is able to assist in our brigade's mission in assisting and advising the Afghan army and fighting and eradicating these violent forces, that would definitely be successful, even if it's a small impact and it increases from there.
Do you have confidence in the president?
I would say so. I think that he has surrounded himself with many seasoned veterans, specifically General Mattis, and these individuals will definitely help advise him and make the correct choices in terms of our military and Department of Defense.
It's currently 2:18 Central Time.
Hours after I left, Max Swan boarded a plane to Afghanistan. I couldn't be with her, so she sent me this recording.
I'm a bit nervous, but excited as well. I don't think it's really hit me that I've really left.
To calm her nerves, she told me she listens to music. Her favorite is a worship song by an Australian band called Hillsong United. Your grace abounds in
deepest waters. I'm excited to see what's in store, and really excited to get to know the mission and understand my job better over there. Come on, sing it
like you believe it. She promised to stay in touch. For the world, Shirin Jafari, Fort Carson Army Base, Colorado Springs.
Shirin's story is part of our Across Women's Lives project, and Shirin has been posting some behind-the-scenes photos from Fort Carson, where you can see Erica McSwan prepare for her deployment. Head over to our Across Women's Lives Instagram page to see that photo essay. That's at Women's Lives, one word. Activists have long raised concerns about the way immigrants are treated after they're detained by ICE, the federal government's Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency. ICE uses detention centers run by contractors. We're going to focus on conditions at one of those facilities, the for-profit Stewart Detention Center in Georgia. Three people being held there have died in less than a year. One of them was Gene Jimenez, who hanged himself with a bedsheet last May. Reporter Robin Yurovich wrote about that case for the online publication Capital and Maine. Robin, your story centers on the life of Gene Jimenez. He was originally from Panama, but he lived most of his life in the U.S. Tell us more about him.
He came to the U.S. when he was 10 years old, and he came on a visa. He overstayed his visa, and he grew up as an American kid. He was from a deeply religious Christian family. And his sister and friends on Facebook and tributes, and one friend that I interviewed, described him as someone who other people really liked to be around. He had a goofy sense of humor and big dreams for his life. He liked music and art, and he wanted to be an architect. But his opportunities were limited because he was undocumented.
So bring us up to the time he was placed in an immigration detention center in Georgia. What had caused him to be put in the immigration detention? You know, how old was he? What was he up to at that point?
Yeah, he was 26 years old. He had mental health issues, and his mental health appeared to really deteriorate in the last 6 months to a year of his life. He had been hospitalized twice for mental health issues. And he had been convicted of three minor crimes, marijuana possession, petty theft, and a charge called simple assault that police papers described as an unwanted hug he gave a woman. He had been serving a 22-day sentence in Raleigh, North Carolina, for those crimes when he was transferred to ICE custody.
And it's clear from your reporting that Jimenez had some serious mental health issues. Were the people at the detention center aware of that?
They were aware of it. They knew that he had been prescribed an antipsychotic drug, and documents showed that they knew about his history of prior suicide attempts. They didn't exactly respond to his mental health issues as they should have. I mean, first of all, he had a really rough time in detention. He was beaten up by another detainee and placed in solitary confinement for that before it was discovered that he was the victim and hadn't fought back. And when he entered detention, he was given just a quarter of the dose of the antipsychotic drug that he'd been prescribed before he was detained. And he had called out by his behavior and by verbal requests for mental health care, but he didn't appear to get what he was asking for, what he needed. And you can hear the despair in his voice in this clip where he's talking to his stepfather from detention. So in this clip, he's talking to his stepfather and he's saying that he's tired of life. He's tired of being subject to the system. He's tired of waking up in the morning.
And at this point, he's kind of slipping away. Tell us at what point he made this call to his father. And did those around him, the guards and those running the detention center, react?
Well, there are multiple calls that he placed to his family, and they're not timestamped, so it's really impossible to tell when he made that call. But it is clear that as his time in detention progressed, he showed a lot of signs that his mental health was deteriorating. At the time of his death, he had been in solitary for 19 days. He had jumped from a second tier in his dormitory to the first. And after he jumped, he told guards, "I'm Julius Caesar," which was something that he would say a lot. But instead of getting him mental health care, he was taken to solitary. I should say, in terms of what the investigation revealed on a larger level about the way people were treated at Stewart, is that although the ICE detention standards say detainees should only be in segregation or solitary for the most serious offenses, and that should be a last resort, there were other people who were there for offenses like horse playing, they called it, or failure to obey. It showed that one man had remained in solitary confinement for 4 months at least. On the day that Jimenez died, I believe that two other men were in there for more than 60 days.
I know President Trump wants to have more immigrants detained and sent to these kind of detention centers. Is there any kind of hold being put on that in light of this suicide?
No, no. So now there are 40,000 detention beds across the country in actually 200 facilities, it appears. And the Trump administration plans to add 12,000 more beds.
Robin Jurevich is a reporter with Capital in Maine. Thanks so much, Robin.
Thanks a lot. Take care.
Robin's article is titled "Deadly Detention, Self-Portrait of a Tragedy." You can read it at PRI.org. Back to our top story, the diplomatic dust-up between Britain and Russia. A quick recap, Britain blames Russia for poisoning a former Russian spy in the UK. Prime Minister Theresa May said the poison was a Russian-made nerve agent, and her government has expelled 23 Russian diplomats in retaliation. Our BBC colleague Sarah Rainsford has been asking different people in Moscow for their reactions. Here's what she got from Pyotr Tolstoy, Speaker of the Russian Parliament.
England will, of course, receive a response to these actions. Even if the UK cuts off diplomatic relations with Russia, it doesn't matter. We don't give a damn.
Analyst Andrei Kartunov says Moscow had been expecting a more robust response from Britain. Diplomatic expulsions are serious, he says, but they're definitely not fatal.
I think one of the characteristics of the current Russian leadership is that it doesn't yield under pressure. The system demonstrates a lot of resilience, and I think that this is likely to continue.
Большое вам всем спасибо. Я вас крепко, крепко обнимаю.
As for Vladimir Putin, he spent the day on the election campaign trail, ending with a concert.
Vladimir Vladimirovich Putin!
This is Crimea, the territory he annexed 4 years ago to an international outcry. Europe and America united then to impose sanctions, but Russia's position never changed. In the case of Sergei Skripal, Britain alone seems unlikely to do better.
The BBC's Sarah Rainsford in Moscow. Yesterday, we heard the sad news that Stephen Hawking had died. And since then, it's become clear, if it wasn't already, just how many people around the globe were inspired by his passion for exploring and understanding the cosmos. People like Sona Hosseini. She was on the show last year, telling us how a visit to a planetarium when she was in first grade jump-started her deep curiosity about space.
I was touched beyond my own understanding of how deep I could be touched. And I remember crying. I didn't want to leave the center. I was asking the lady, how can I work here? The lady told me, oh, honey, you should have a PhD. I didn't know what a PhD was. My best choice was like to go home and tell my mom I need a PhD. We'll go and buy it. And next thing, I'll be back there.
It took a while, but eventually Sona did get her PhD. She now works at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California, and she joins us now. Sona, it sounds like that trip to the planetarium had a big influence on your life. When did you first learn about Stephen Hawking and his work?
I learned about Stephen Hawking in college, but I was reading his book in junior high and high school, and I didn't know who he was. I stumbled through his book, A Brief History of Time, in a bookstore where I was looking for biography of Feynman, Heisenberg. I remember it as if it was yesterday. This little book grabbed my attention. I purchased it, and I lived with it for many years before I knew who he was.
When you first encountered his book, A Brief History of Time, what was it about it that drew you to it?
It was the title, A Brief History of Time, and I was about 14 years old. We went back to Iran, and I was fascinated with the philosophy of science. I remember reading the title in Farsi, A Brief History of Time, and I was like, it can't be a brief history of time. Time has the longest history of anything in the world. So I got the book out of What Could This Be About, and I carried it with myself for about 2-3 years everywhere.
You literally carried the book with you?
I did. I remember we went for hiking with friends, and we went to the top of the mountain, and everybody were like talking together, and I went and I sat somewhere quiet, and I started reading the book for the 50th time. And when I heard his passing, it took me back to the top of that mountain with me and his book.
What did Stephen Hawking mean to you as a young scientist?
Oh, he means a lot. He means a lot to many people. We have a relationship with these people and the way that they think, and we have never met them in person. And that's what people like Stephen Hawking do. You have a relationship with them. For scientists, this is what romance is. You think together, they influence your path in life, and it's through books.
Stephen Hawking was an inspiration to a lot of people, and not just because of his research and theories. Why do you think people were so drawn to him?
There's a story between Einstein and Charlie Chaplin, which I can't verify, but it says Charlie Chaplin tells Einstein, everybody loves me and everybody loves you because everybody understands me and nobody understands you. You know, a great thing about great scientists like Stephen Hawking is he takes complex understandings and puts it in a very simple way that a junior high school student in Iran, in a tiny city named Zanjan, can stumble through his book and, you know, read it. There aren't many things in life that penetrates in everybody's life. That's power. That's power and beauty, both together. He's a person that you always want to meet. He was in Big Bang Theory, and I was like always waiting for him to come back to Pasadena so I could go and meet him. But living with him is following his path and, you know, being curious.
What's the focus of your work for NASA at the Jet Propulsion Lab?
I am developing the next generation of miniaturized high-resolution spectrometers for space missions. There are very interesting measurements in isotopic ratios, and I would like to make them available to make those measurements remotely.
What are you excited to learn more about in, you know, I don't know, next 5 or 10 years? I know that's a tiny fraction of time.
But there's so much we can do. I like to learn more about where the water on Earth came from, you know, gather more information about that, and the water processes in solar system. That's my scientific focus.
What advice do you think Stephen Hawking might have for you?
Never give up and never stop watching the stars. Yeah, never give up. Just the curiosity. and be excited for it. Stephen Hawking, look at how awesome scientist and a great personality he was, just how he overcame. It wasn't easy. He did not have superpowers. He made an exceptional person out of himself. I have to admit, I can't imagine how would life be without him in our generation. It's really, really sad. But in astronomy, when a big star, a giant star dies, they go and then they explode and the nebula comes and then the cloud comes. Many other stars are born after a great star dies. And that reminds me of big people too. People like Stephen Hawking. When they pass away, many more stars are born.
Sona Hosseini works at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much.
Many more stars are born. I like that. And that's our show today from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston. I'm Carol Hills. Back tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.